Welcome to Planet Poetry. My name is Peter Kenny.
And I'm Robin Houghton. And in this episode, we're talking to Martin Crucifix about his latest collection, Between a Drowning Man.
We'll also talk about Claire Blest's latest collection and take our chances with Richard Berengarten's Changing. And content warning, we'll be discussing content warnings.
But before that, let's hear what Martin Crucifix had to say to Peter.
Martin Crucifix is a poet, teacher and translator and has won an Eric Gregory Award and a Hawthornden Fellowship. His blog is highly regarded too. He's had a long engagement with poetry in German, translating Rilke's Duino elegies and the Sonnets to Orpheus in publications from Enitharmon in the 2010s. These Numbered Days, a translation of poems by Peter Huschel, Shearsman Books 2019, won the 2020 Schlegel Tieck Prize for Poetry Translation. Since his debut collection Beneath Tremendous Rain in 1990, Martin's had 11 other publications of his own poetry, which include A Cargo of Limbs from Hercules Editions in 2019, The Lovely Disciplines, Seren Books in 2017, the chapbooks A Hatfield Mess, Warple Press 2014, and The Time We Turned from Shearsman, also 2014, and Hurt from Enitharmon in 2010. Today, however, we're going to talk about his new book, Between a Drowning Man, which has just been published this autumn, 2023, by Salt. So, Martin Crucifix, welcome to Planet Poetry.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Martin, where are you speaking to us from today?
I'm speaking from North London, not much distance from Alexandra Palace, where the BBC made their first broadcasts.
One hopes that ours will be marginally have marginally better quality than that one. You never know, though. Today we're going to talk to you about what I think is a really exceptional collection of poetry, Between a Drowning Man. I think it's just been released into the wild now, isn't it? We're talking in October 2020.
It has, just in the last couple of weeks. Yes, that's right.
Between a Drowning Man is built from two sequences of poetry. The sort of epicness about your ambition in this, you know, what for you is the attraction of writing these long sequences?
Oh, it's interesting you ask. And actually looking back, I can see how drawn to long sequences I've been ever since the beginning, really. My first book had a sequence of poems which was built around, I think, the three scripts on the Rosetta Stone. Robert Lowell, who said, you know, poetry is not the record of an event, it is an event in itself. And I've never really been able to see that event in isolation. There's always a before and after. There's always a speaker with a past and a future, someone forever changing their mind. Maybe this says something about me. And I think that's what I'm after in these sequences. And clearly, just looking back at those early ones, I'd been interested in this idea long before I came across the sort of granddaddy of these sequences, Rilke's Duino Elegies, which I ended up translating.
Well, the first sequence in the book is called Work and Days, which is a hat tilt to Hesiod, which you argue in your introduction is probably the oldest poem in the Western canon, one that deals with a dispute between two brothers.
That's right, yeah.
Did Hesiod light the fuse for the sequence?
The simple answer to that is plain no, to be honest.
That's interesting.
The Works and Days sequence had a very long gestation. It was back in 2016, I think it was, and I'd come across the Penguin classic book called Speaking of Shiva. And this is a book of translations by A.K. Ramanujan. Ramanujan, he was translating poems written long ago, 10th, 11th, 12th century southern India, written in the language called Kannada. And these are vakana, brief praise songs. What was so interesting, they're written in an incredibly direct, free verse, very colloquially, astonishingly frank. They're not just poems of love of the god and devotion, but of anger and frustration and resentment, a huge range of emotions. In the winter of 2016, they somehow appealed to me, and I just began jotting down sort of models of them in a notebook. I think interesting to me, or even liberating, you might say, is they use a great deal of repetition. And there's a refrain at the end of each poem, which is an address to the god. And I've made a version of that in my poems as well.
The sequence starts with invitation.
Invitation. To talk about difference with its ambiguous double birth, its whelping of conflict and war, ubiquitous. So there seems nothing we might love it for, but the might you have, the fear of its loss. Why make it a god? Why impressed by spite? How world's complexity makes us dread it more, makes us other everything and everyone we meet. Instead, say something, something of difference with its sudden, sometimes shocking riches, an othering to hone attention, not dull it. Say what scares you. Nothing but the might you have, the dread of its loss. These mongrel forms, this way of saying, come, talk. Because, tell me, when was it ever news? When talk turns to purity, there has already been too much noise.
It's both left and right justified as a kind of almost conversation with a yes. gap running through the middle of the text. I felt that you seemed to be saying that the job of language is to bridge the gaps between people, and that these mongrel forms, this way of saying, you know, is kind of poetry, and it's got the potential to bridge between people. I love this phrase, say what scares you.
Yeah.
This sequence goes on to deal with polarization in the UK since Brexit by people like Trump and the divisions that are opening up between people.
Yes. So,
how can writing poetry help?
I think this is a poem where the Hesiod example is coming to the fore. And as you mentioned before, there's a dispute which seems to be going on with the Hesiod's narrator's brother. And we don't know whether the brother existed or not, or whether he's just a literary device. But Hesiod says that there are two kinds of conflict. One form of a discord or strife creates a war. But the other one is a kind of more benign sense of competition, spurs us on, energizes and enriches. And I think those are the two types of difference I ended up calling it in this poem. And obviously, as you've said, politics of any age really can agitate for one type of strife or the other. And yes, you've already mentioned the elephant in the room here, which was Brexit, of course, which in 2016, I'm sure all of our listeners can remember this vividly and personally. The UK was in a complete turmoil. And the idea of bridges, the refrain that I ended up using instead of the Vakana poem's allusions and addresses to the god Shiva, I ended up really using what I was seeing outside the window. One, it was a time of great storms, Storm Desmond, I think it was, which in particular caused massive flooding and damage, and bridges were literally being smashed. But it was echoed politically. I think this idea of say what scares you and the idea also of othering. If we are kept poor, then we are more easily manipulated. It's more easy to get people to see the difference and to other in a very negative sort of way. Mm. So, yeah, I think that does relate to the shape of the poem, which, as you say, is two columns, and it's a question about what lies between.
But I think we should move on to the poem that's called Like Crimes Woven into the Weft. And your poems in the rest of the section are named after the first line, aren't
they? Yes, yeah. Like crimes woven into the weft of a T-shirt, waiting on the reduced rail. Like the shape of the skull, no one remarks in the flushed cheeks of the newborn. Like envy, buried long years in the black heart of expressed admiration. Like sunshine that is really the withering of night poured into soil where wheat grows. Like the million tons of water lying interred beneath the city of London. Like a bank of cloud, the gathering of more clouds above Threadneedle Street. So it is, in and around and over and above. All the bridges are down.
Yeah, and here we have the first example of that refrain of all the bridges are down. It seems to sort of ring out like a doomy bell through through this collection. I love this idea of subterranean grudges, you know, of resentment actually being woven into the clothes that we wear.
Yes.
And this envy buried long years in the black heart of expressed admiration. You're exploring resentments that threaten to undermine everything. There's that image of great amounts of water underneath the city of London.
Looking at it now, it sort of gets potentially quite apocalyptic, doesn't it? But it is all to do with the subterranean negativities, which I was feeling, I guess, around the time and have certainly not gone away. It's certainly dealing with conflicts and injustices, envy, environmental issues are there, I think, in the sunshine reference. You can hear the repetition in this poem as well, like this, like that, like the other. And that was something I would never have allowed myself to do, I don't think, without these little Vakana poem models. And it turned out they were able to contain multitudes, really, without breaking down as a piece of poetry.
Well, what I like also is, you know, getting under the skin of those people that are resenting, finding a sympathy with that resentment and trying to understand it. What we're all doing now is completely writing off the other side, whatever that other side is, because they don't think like us. And I think, you know, that idea of poetry actually being the thing of empathy and is a marvelous thing in this poem.
Yes. It's interesting you say it rings like a kind of ominous death knell or something through the whole sequence. I'm hoping that these bridges become transmuted and transformed into something slightly different. But certainly early in the sequence, it's to do with the breaking down of communications, of the kind of atomization of society. And that's the initial state, certainly in this poem sequence, where we and in many ways where we are now.
Why isn't everybody writing this? Because the divisions in society that, you know, need to be bridged are so there for everyone to see. But what is so remarkable about this collection is that you're actually tackling that head on in a way that I haven't seen other people do. As a lifelong hypochondriac, I was particularly drawn to your poem, Before the Doctor Asks to Examine.
I'll read that one. Before the doctor asks to examine my water, before I piss into the bottle provided, before my skin goes up in flames, before I can't turn over in bed, before the frequently inexplicable dizzy spells, before the morning after, the drunken night before, before the chocolate ice cream half pound of butter binge sluiced down the toilet, before the drag and ache of the iron anchor from left nipple to upper left arm, before the silica crystals burst in my hip, before the onset of my gouty, swollen left ankle, before my male companion with his longer striding makes it impossible for me to keep up with him, before the pavement leaps towards me, makes sickening contact with my right cheek, before the paramedics in their green uniforms, before I am lifted bodily into the air like fallen stock, I remember what I briefly forgot to remember. Of course, all the bridges are down.
When the bridges are down, help can't come. In recent COVID times, that the help that we kind of took for granted isn't available. But it also talks to a kind of existential aloneness when you've got all these horrible afflictions.
Yes, you know, this sequence and I think this poem would have been amongst them actually predate COVID.
Oh.
So there's almost something prophetic going on here.
You're a dangerous man, Martin.
I mean, it's interesting or depressing in many ways how little has changed. Even the COVID simply taught us perhaps what Brexit was teaching us before. I wasn't really sure whether what I thought of for a long time as my Brexit poems would really have an afterlife. But I think with the pandemic and so on, I decided in the end that they did. They remained relevant.
Will you read To Tell the Truth, It's Hardly More?
To tell the truth, it's hardly more than a convenient extension to the back lot of the forecourt of my local BP garage on the northernmost side of this satellite town. Yet we all agree it's an excellent shop, which means we'll be back here tomorrow and the next day, most likely. And in this way, family traditions put down roots. As today, we buy tampons and baked beans, a salad bag, and a brace of frozen garlic bread. At the very last moment, we choose to snatch up a print newspaper from its rack with its bold and reassuring headline, "All bridges fit for purpose," says government minister.
I was feeling it was describing a kind of shop being established, and there's a slightly grudging acceptance, yet we all agree it's an excellent shop. Despite all that, it's also a purveyor of untruths. All bridges fit for purpose, say government minister.
Yes.
You know, it's another way of, you know, showing how division prospers and how pervasive and insidious it is.
It was in that winter of 2016, we stayed for a while in Cumbria, which is also why the Storm Desmond storm damage was so evident at every twist and turn, really. And this is a garage come shop on the outskirts of Keswick, which proved, as the poem says, very useful and convenient. It was kind of being away from home. I became conscious that these little routines that we develop as family become traditions. Back in my childhood, my job was to walk around the housing estate to the local shop and get the bread for the day. And that's become almost mythic in my memory. And I think that's how we make sense of things, by joining things. Across time, these things become significant and ultimately meaningful for us within our own lives. And those, again, in this case, it's the government minister, wish to promulgate lies, fake news, whatever we want to call it. Ultimately, the effect of that is to make our own experience through time become disconnected and meaningless.
Can we now read Between a Drowning Man, which is the title of your book?
Between a drowning man and my child's skinny dipping, between lip and kiss, between brother and estranged younger brother, between mother and one of her six children, between the kissing gate and the coffin root, between cup and lip, between the first slurp and sip, between the fiberglass fishing rod and the spinning lure, between old Capague and Montulet, between the will and the contraction of the atrophied muscles, between town and country, between wealth and what is a simple lack of money, between the biscuit tin they put their money in, and fake news, a hedge fund, or tabloid confessions of sin. The letter, unsent, the deleted email, the skillfully incised lapidary inscription, tragically lost, with its improbable cost, with its always and forever critical burden. Words scrawled on a scrap of paper by someone, by the old gods of rumour. All the bridges are falling down.
There are irreconcilable opposites in there, people who put their money in biscuit tins versus those with hedge funds and so on.
Yes.
I wonder just how hopeful you are personally that these chasms can be bridged. It was making me think of St. John of the Cross, you know, this idea of the via negativa, that you've got to somehow abandon all hope before you get a glimpse of the divine somehow. Is this a kind of, you know, are you writing these challenging things down to somehow get to a point where a union could be glimpsed.
Absolutely. Your reading is very astute there, I think. This poem comes immediately after a poem, an Americano to Go, which keeps asking. It lists things again in the fashion of these Vacana poems, but it keeps repeating not so much the bridges are down, but when were they kin? When were these things family? When were these things connected? And I think my implication most definitely is, when will they be kin again? And I think, going back to where we began, really, what is the interest in a sequence of poems? I'm hoping the sequence takes the reader from somewhere which I think we'll all find instantly recognizable, but to a place where things are potentially more connected.
There are times in the collection where incidents from your own life seem to really penetrate. In the poem, "At My Mother's High Bleached Bedside," is a good example of that. Would you read that for us?
Yes, that's in fact the poem that immediately follows the Drowning Man poem. I mean, the people who put their money into the biscuit tin, they are my parents. And they do crop up on a number of occasions, and this is definitely one of them. At my mother's high bleached bedside, a couple of transparent drips, the monitors bleeping, and across the ward, a woman, mostly of skin and bone, cries out to me, "Is that your daughter?" And though I have a grown-up daughter, she's not here. So can I laugh it off as so much senile rapture, though it's not easy? "Is that your daughter?" now she is repeating, and I wonder what is it she thinks she sees, and would it be acceptable to question her about it, what it is? Who do you believe is standing beside me, though you see nothing? I'm sure she sees nothing of what's actually here, and she proves it, with her wide-eyed gazing into the white scrubbed air, repeating, "Look at the bees swarm. Oh, look at the bees, how they swarm where the bridges are down."
Yeah. This line, "I'm sure she sees nothing of what's actually there."
Yes.
And then seeing a swarm of bees. For some reason, I had this biblical thing about Samson finding honey in the body of a dead lion come to me.
That's really interesting. I'd never thought of that. I can remember that sitting on the tea time table at home. That wasn't it, Lyle's Golden Syrup.
I think. Yes, that's
right.
And they had
the picture of the lion and the bees. What was the "out of the strong came forth sweetness"? I think was the presumably biblical strap line, as it were.
This is kind of somebody bridging a gap with something other people can't see, but maybe pointing to something outside the poem, which is huge.
As far as I remember, this actually happened, or something very like it actually happened. Hamlet's mother is here as well. When Hamlet is seeing the ghost of his father, Gertrude says, "You know, there's nothing there, yet all that is I see." And she's very confident that she can see everything that's there. But clearly not. Shakespeare allows the audience to see the ghost, I think. And this woman, at least in the poem, is, I think, doing the same thing, that there is a sort of a madness here. But it's a madness that I would want to be positive about. There are moments, perhaps, when we can see further possibilities. As you say, we can see beyond the mere surface of things. And I think the bees are one of the moments in the whole sequence, a more positive, sweet element creeping into the poem.
So can we now read "This Morning Round Noon," which is the last poem in this sequence?
"This morning round noon, we scattered the ashes, like, click, like. My son, Tom, today is 21 and 50 grand in debt, like, share. I took her to see, can you ever forgive me? A glorious start to the day, like, share. I love snorkeling with turtles, the sort of sentence that seems never to end. Sadly, no one thought to return my psychic tote bag. My condolences on the occasions I speak of him, he will be nameless in passing. Great job, heart, you Brighton women. Like Rishi snapped this one on his morning run on the winding path over Galbarrow to gather in the market square, like, share. In the struggle, share. Like-minded children fall out of the sky. Oh, I adore that photograph, my father's look, and how I loved his hat, like a trumpet, for whatever is redacted. Like, government exists to promote and protect the ordinary happiness of its people. Share, your cool and gentle peppermint, beautifully crystallized hibiscus flowers. I was hit by a car, like share, but I'm okay. A blow to my shoulder, but I rolled with it, plus a dash of syrup. Share. The bridges, all blue, sugarcane, rum, like. An American punk band from Nashville posting abuse about a young Buddhist woman refusing anesthetic to share. Are you feeling blue? Smiley face icon. Like. We chanced across a bar where folk song and klezmer were being played, as in a mirror. Share, as in a mirror. The world of frost on the Vitosha Mountain. I say, the Pantone chart is one of my favourite things.
This is a great poem, I think. At first I thought it was, there's an element of frowning at the superficiality and untrustworthiness of social media. Yeah. But it just blossoms out and becomes fuller and fuller. Something about ending with a Pantone chart, we're at last glimpsing a world that has got shades and it's not so black and white.
No.
I found this quite a kind of hopeful ending.
I have to say, almost all of the details here were harvested, as it were, from various social media channels. So I hope none of my friends recognize themselves. I do have, as I guess all of us do have, a pretty equivocal view of social media. I mean, for lots of people, it's a lifesaver in many ways. But too much of it can be really poisonous. And I've certainly felt this personally, you know, that the kind of edited, triumphant bragging that goes on can be really, really dispiriting, even for somebody of my age.
And poets aren't immune from that, are they?
Absolutely not. And of course, that burnished and polished view of the self is just not true. Poems just before this enact a scattering of ashes, really, a sort of a metaphorical sort of death of the self. And that is where I'm trying to suggest that the release from the boundaries of self and egotism and selfishness and self-obsession, if they can be dissolved even momentarily, then perhaps we get a glimpse of the Pantone chart of multicolored richness. And it's the totality of all things, really. I mean, this is something I've learned and taken over from my work on Rilke, who I think actually probably is more relevant to the second sequence, which we might move on to.
Oh, to the edge of the gorge. I found a review of this sequence in the Glasgow Review of Books. It was talking about you and in connection with Rilke.
Yes.
It talks about a concern with approach to a beyond, the precipice at which you teeter, the O that calls to gone things, retracing. It goes on to say, all things are drawn towards the gorge, the bees, the doves, the poet, the buzzard that takes the place of Rilke's angels. Even the nearby towns and their historical occupants seem to be tumbling inexorably into its maw. Yet the gorge is full of life, the scufflings of small creatures, the bodies, the voices of mythic lovers. I thought that was such a good description of you're taking us to this edge of this gorge. The O, you suspect, is an Orpheus, and, you know, Martin Crucifix is this modern day Orpheus, and we're trotting down into the gorge with him.
That's exactly right, yes. And the O is, he's definitely myself on many, many occasions. The landscape here, I felt this was a really nice contrast with the earlier sequence, which is so sort of contemporary UK with all its rather grubby details and so on. This is in the east of Italy, between the Apennine Mountains and the Adriatic. A lot of the poem is about the landscape here, rocky hillsides and little villages and deep valleys and gorges. As I say, Rilke, his interest in Orpheus for me is that Orpheus descended into Hades, into death, in order to try and recover Eurydice, but then re-emerged. He is a figure who countered the darkness, but was not destroyed by it, and emerged singing. And as I understand Rilke anyway, it is that the gulf between life and death, which we are encouraged and told and instructed and taught, is so absolute and unavoidable. He didn't really feel that. He felt that both life and death were part of a wholeness. And the gorge is a sort of a version of that, including the darkness and the dangers. Again, without social media, we tend to curate and edit out of our feeds a lot of the darkness. And
you assemble a wealth of influences, you know, Rilke, Dante, Hesiod, the Vachana poets.
Yes.
I thought I found traces of Blake. Do you think of yourself as a modernist writer, or is that something you don't entertain?
I think it's probably something I don't entertain. One has to be modernist. We're in 2023 or even postmodern. I mean, I perhaps become clear, I am godless. I have a sense of fluidity of categories. When things become rigid and fixed, think life goes wrong, I think. Modernist also often implies for readers very difficult, fragmentary, maybe not much concerned with communicating with the reader. And I wouldn't want to be seen in that light. I think more often of somebody like Edward Thomas,
yes,
or Robert Frost. Yeah. They're definitely modernist, but they would be modernist in the way that perhaps one would like to be read.
One of your characteristics is taking those influences and not, they never come across as stale.
I kind of relate it also to my, relatively late flowering interest in translation, which really started up with the Rilke, which I would never have touched if I was more knowledgeable about such things. But with translation, one has, this feels to me just stating the bloody obvious, really, but it is a great deal to do with empathy, with entering into the original source text. And I think that the same could be said perhaps about the Hesiod, which is a very peculiar poem in many ways, sort of part farming manual, part family drama. But I think you can get deeply into it, and from a position in the heart of it, then you can move out and develop it and make use of it for your own purposes. I'm hopefully not in any kind of exploitative fashion. I find myself writing quite a lot of ekphrastic poems recently as well, poems, so taking a painting or a sculpture or something like that, some other art form, and developing a poem from that. And I'm obviously quite drawn to that sort of method. It's probably a weakening of my own fundamental originality.
Well, you're in dialogue with the greats.
Well, that's a very positive way to put it. Yes, thank you.
The sequence, O to the Edge of the Gorge, is in sonnet form.
Yeah.
So would you read the final two sonnets for us?
It's a crown of sonnets. So the opening lines are the same as the preceding line. And these last two sonnets, I've talked about the idea of a turn, as it were, within a sequence where a situation alters and develops. And this is certainly after the turn in this sequence. You can hear from this, the opening lines. The gorge is referred to here, as I've said, the presence of death in many ways. And here, I think, the image of the bird of prey, the buzzard, significant of that. And the buzzard here has caught something, some sort of rat or rodent or something, is flying off with it. Yes, perhaps he can build something on that. Yet up from the depths of the gorge sways a lurching raptor in its dark silhouette, a winged shape that in his eye resolves to complications of feathered legs and talons, her tilted steering tail, yet more legs and a second dangling tail. She gains height, gains a steadier balance to skim hedgerows towards the bloody festival of the bird. And for this other, nothing but the brevity of time. Too late, it occurs to him, the terrible shortness of time, remaining unless its vision involves the hawk, how soon the creature dies. All creatures die sooner, blind to the hawk. Left clutching no more than this, as if the hammock he occupies each night, and all night too, as if strung out across the gorge from one limestone outcrop to a distant second, its stand of trees, its shivering of poplars, for once he sways there, not falling, yet not ever at ease with these thinnest of airs beneath him, these shapes of loose knotted mesh, these whisperings that cradle him on a whim, he wants to call it, yet more steady, perhaps, this whim, this wish, this risky flight in the fleeting black wake of the carpenter bees.
I couldn't help but feel those bees have come from your mother's bedside somehow.
I think they are operating in exactly the same way, yes.
This image of the hawk in the penultimate sonnet, you say, too late it occurs to him the terrible shortness of time remaining unless its vision involves the hawk, how soon the creature dies. There's something about having all of us having to accommodate the idea of the hawk, this swooping death into our vision. Was that your intention?
Absolutely, yes. As I think I've said before, I mean, this is something one has learned from Rilke. It's to argue against an edited view of life, of just human experience. And as I say, Keats has really clear and important things to say along the same lines, that life and death are part of this wholeness of being, to give it a grand name. And that is also why in preceding sequence there is a sort of metaphorical death towards the end. We have to escape our own self's rigid boundaries in order to have a more true relationship with the world around us and our own experience, I think. And I think the hawk here doesn't really represent or replace Rilke's angels. The hawk is an image of death and danger and negativity. And I guess the poem is suggesting, through imagery at least, that the creature, ourselves, we live better when we are conscious of those dangers. The final sonnet here sort of pictures the poet reclining in a hammock. I think I was thinking about Ken Smith, who has a poem of that, the poet reclining, I think. The net here is the little shapes of the loose knotted mesh. I was definitely thinking of the shape of the little poems, the squares of the sonnet, which support but don't create a kind of rigidity. So whimsical, possibly wishful, possibly risky, definitely. But if we can follow the bees towards the honeypot, then that would be the way to go.
Well, Martin, we're going to leave you there reclining.
Thank you very much.
Reclining on your hammock. I think Between a Drowning Man is a real achievement. I think it's a marvellous book. So thank you again for giving us your time for the Planet Poetry podcast.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure.
I thought this collection sounded really interesting, and particularly that first section, The Works and Days,
Yeah, I think I said to him in the interview, it's just like, why isn't everybody writing this? Because it just suddenly seems such an essential topic, you know, that the idea of the divisions between people. And yes. Right now, you know, that's all we talk about is just how far apart and polarized everybody is. And this is all about how do you bridge that gap? And let's have a look at that gap.
Yes, yes. I liked the refrain of the bridges being down and yeah. Sometimes it's slightly different, wasn't it? I thought that really gave a really interesting continuity. Being a bit of an ignoramus myself, I sort of have heard the name Hesiod, but I didn't know anything about what he'd written or when. Was this something that you were familiar with before?
No, I wasn't actually. I had to, before I spoke to Martin, had to Google and find out and read a little bit, a tiny bit of the text. That book, Speaking of Shiva, had actually been on my bookshelves for about 40 years.
Really?
I kind of remember dipping into it and then it's left mouldering and gradually going yellow. And I picked it up again the other day and I thought, wow, yeah, these are great. But that's an example of why you shouldn't throw books away, really, because...
I loved these Vakana poems. And interesting link with the last podcast when we spoke to Leon Schifflin about using the first line being the title of the poem being the first line of the of the poem. And, of course, that's the form all the way through, isn't it, for these?
Yeah.
And this idea of them being to praise the god Shiva, but also expressing all kinds of personal anger and distress and puzzlement, very much like the Psalms in the Bible, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you've got your some Psalms are definitely praise Psalms, but quite a lot of them are things like, oh God, you know, my neighbours just ripped me off and I'm really pissed off and, you know, all these kind of things that have happened.
Like crimes woven into the weft. You know, just the idea of resentment being just woven into clothes, literally, but also woven into the fabric of the city and undermining that, like he says, the million tons of water lying interred beneath the city of London.
Yes, wasn't that an image to think about? Sort of you're thinking about interred, you know, and ready to burst at any time and drown us all.
Yeah. I often think that about London. It's kind of like a Swiss cheese, really, that you're walking around on the surface, but there's so many tunnels and buried rivers and tube trains and,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
What you think is really solid is actually quite airy underneath sometimes.
Oh, no.
He does talk about the divisions in society and how it leads to people feeling isolated, you know, like that one, before the doctor asks to examine my water.
Yes,
you know, before I piss into the bottle provided, and it, you know, then you go through a list of unspeakable ailments and things. That sense of just isolation, and like all many of the others, it ends with that all the bridges are down.
Yes,
that somehow you're alone facing this.
It struck me from the start, this invitation, and like you pointed out, it's in these two columns. So you've got these two adversaries almost, you know, facing off. A great way of kicking off the book.
Yeah, visiting his mother, seeing things that aren't there and kind of seeing beyond. And what are they seeing? You know, is that real? There's something quietly philosophical and absolutely brilliant about this sequence.
That a lot of people have written about Brexit and their feelings of anguish and despair about the whole business of the country feeling split. But although it's personal, it doesn't have any sort of, hasn't got any kind of a ranty feel about it.
Yeah.
It's stepping back, as you say, looking at it sort of philosophically almost.
Yeah, it's like he's in a intellectual helicopter looking down on it.
But there's no sense of that he's not engaged with it. There's no sense of there being no emotion behind it.
Yeah. I love his influences. You know, he was talking a lot about Rilke. And I remember reading Rilke for the first time when I was about 21. And it absolutely just blew my mind. And the Duino Elegies, this long sequence that inspired him. And actually, loads of Martin Crucifix's books are in sequences, you know, not just this one. The Orpheus poems, the Ode to the Edge of the Gorge. You know, which is quite weird that when you read the whole Crown of Sonnets, he's describing this great gorge and again, you know, sort of gulf, go down into the gulf and it's full of life and death, this kind of semi-Italian landscape, but of the imagination.
Yeah, it's definitely got that Dante-esque feel, doesn't it, with the landscape and the hawk.
Really strong book, I think. I hope it gets as much attention as it deserves because it's politically interesting without telling you what to think, but also is full of much older and richer poetic trains of thought.
Really interesting interview. So it's called Between a Drowning Man. published by Salt.
Martin Crucifix, just released October 23. So, Robin, you've been reading a work by one of our previous guests and also personal friend of this podcast. Would you like to tell us about
Indeed.
It? We're all sitting comfortably,
yes, yes. A big friend of Planet Poetry, Claire Best, has got another book out. And we were both at the launch in London, weren't we? Peter, you were the compere even, I believe.
Yeah, I think partially because of interviewing her that Claire was kind enough to ask me. Turned into a bit of a lively session with Claire taking 7 hours to travel the 40 miles from Suffolk.
Oh, she had a nightmare journey, didn't she? Yeah, that was so, I felt for her. But actual fact, even though the first half of the launch, she wasn't there, it kind of built the energy up in the room, didn't it? It was the expectation, like, oh my God, Claire's arrived. Everyone was so excited.
It's like, yeah, waiting for Godot, and Godot actually turns up in the second half.
It was great. And there was a lot of love in the room for Claire,
yeah,
because
definitely.
She is one of these people that is such a great collaborator. We said this before, but she always encompasses and embraces other people in her practice and in her events. And it's always a pleasure to go to a launch of one of Claire's books. So this is called Beyond the Gate and published by Warple Press. If you've not read any Claire Best, I think this is quite a nice introduction in a way, because we have the beautiful, beautiful poems of landscape and nature that I always associate with her. Also poems about the body, the more sort of visceral, personal, really quite edgy themes as well. The heart of the book is an extremely moving, long poem called Salting, about a miscarriage, and it's powerful stuff. Also, she's very good at experimenting with form, and we've got a poem called Late Fig, and it's in the shape of a fig. There's a very clever poem called Geological Section, and the way it's written in a sort of mirror format, three stanzas of three lines, then a single line, and then three more stanzas of three lines, and the lines turn in the middle. They go backwards, as it were. So it does sort of look like the strata of a rock, but also it reminded me of the rings of a tree, you know, the concentric circles. So yes, we've got experiment in form and always this wonderful connection to life and death, frankly. And she said something, didn't she, in her launch, that she's not afraid of the word death and it's... Yeah. Part of life.
Typical of her quiet bravery.
It's just a complete engagement with being alive. Shall I read a poem from it?
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
There are poems towards the end. There's one called My Possible Deaths. And I was fascinated by these death poems, as it were. But I'm not going to read one of those. I'm going to read one of the beautiful, beautiful poems in a section called By Water. The first one is called Three Poems About Fog. But three poems, but actually they all fit on one page. So the last one is only two lines long, I think. I was reminded of the beginning of that collection by Alice Oswald. Was it Falling Awake? Where it starts with a short story of falling. And this is the story of the falling rain.
Oh, yes.
To turn into a leaf and fall again. So this is called Three Poems About Fog. That morning, we left the house in fog, drove to the airport through fog. Foggy when we parked, checked in, climbed the steps to the plane. Only a short flight, in and out of cloud, and the place we landed flat and thick with fog. On the train, grey glass, grey air, nothing to drink but water vapour. For a week, I never saw the far bank of the river, your hand reaching for mine. We were close, but kept losing each other. Back home, fog rolled off the sea. Now it swirls around the sofa, the fridge, our kitchen table with its pile of keys. Before, I'd only known fog over ice and known the ice was thin and heard it crack. Look out, thin ice, I'd tell myself. Step back, run. But I stayed with you, and ice, and fog.
Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
That kind of sense of almost losing each other and, you know, not seeing the way forward.
Yeah, yeah. And this is definitely something Claire does a lot. She'll look into nature and the outside and bring it into your life, into her life, into the lives of people. So it's just interconnectivity between human life and the natural world, which is lovely.
Yeah, timeless stuff.
So that's me. And how about you, Peter? Tell us what you've been reading.
I'd like to tell you a story, Robin, of a young thief named Peter Kenny who stole a book from my brother. My brother and I were both very interested in our teens in things like tarot cards and
astrology.
And one of the books that my brother bought was called the I Ching, the Book of Changes. And it's a sort of ancient Chinese text that is used for divination, a quick way of consulting the oracle, i.e. looking into the book, is by getting three coins in your hands and shaking them and then casting them and noting whether they're heads or tails and repeating this process six times. And each time you throw these coins, it corresponds with a kind of line, either broken or unbroken. And you write these six lines down and then you get this thing called a hexagram. Due to the scoring of it, that hexagram changes into another hexagram, and that kind of gives you a, this is where you are now, this is where you'll be, and this is the kind of things you have to think about. So it's really fascinating, very philosophically written.
Does it help you pick your lottery numbers as well, and that sort of thing?
Yeah, no, it absolutely doesn't, but is open to ridicule, all these things are. But
Sorry.
Well, you know, affronted, but but the version that I stole from my brother has an introduction by Jung, the, you know, famous father of psychoanalysis and so on. The two things I learned from it were that it incorporates chance, so it invites you to throw these coins. And rather than that just being simply random nonsense, as, you know, a Western mind would think about it, it actually says, you know, the world is very chaotic, so if you're going to make a decision, you need to incorporate something that's chaotic and unpredictable as well. And as a budding writer, it made me think random things are a part of the story as well.
I think that is scientific, isn't it? I mean, does not science, as sort of the highest level of mathematics, you know, incorporate a certain amount of probability or fuzziness, you know?
I'm not au fait with the highest levels of mathematics. You know, if you keep consulting this book, you start to think of it as a almost like a person, because it's offering you sagacious advice.
And sounds like it leaves space for you to also come into it and interpret, I suppose. So it's not a kind of definitive, like being given advice or something. So in a way, it's almost like the kind of the process of going through counselling or something, where you actually do the work, as it were.
Quite possibly. I hadn't thought of it like that. So the idea of a book that's haunted by a sort of consciousness, very appealing. And I stole this wholesale for a musical piece I did with my collaborator, Matthew Pollard, called This Concert Will Fall in Love With You, where a piece of music was haunted by a consciousness. But anyway, that's a long way of saying I've been reading this collection by Richard Berengarten called Changing, and it's a series of poems that are based on the I Ching. It's from Sheersman Books, almost the size of Cantos. It's up there with that volume. Richard Berengarten, born in 1943 in England, but he's lived all over the place and written in other languages and also published as Richard Burns, but Richard Berengarten has won a bazillion awards. And I'm ashamed to say that I didn't really know of his work.
No, I've not heard of him.
Just the idea that somebody had written this collection of poems that engaged with the I Ching so deeply was fascinating to me. I haven't read it all because it's a huge tome, and I just plunged in and read maybe the first 20%. I'll read a bit from the I Ching and then the poem that he's written that's kind of arisen out of it.
Ah, perfect.
So the bit from the I Ching says, "Waiting in the meadow, it furthers one to abide in what endures, no blame. That's the line, and then I Ching has a commentary about it. It says, the danger is not yet close. One is still waiting on the open plain. Conditions are still simple, yet there is a feeling of something impending. One must continue to lead a regular life as long as possible. Only in this way does one guard against a premature waste of strength, keep free of blame and error that would become a source of weakness later on. So you can see it's kind of fairly practical in its tone. This is a very famous early translation by Richard Wilhelm, who translated it into German. And then it was rendered into English by Carrie F. Baines. And that's the version with a foreword by C.G. Jung. Poem arising from that is called Ordinary. Outwardly lacking an eye, though being all eye, with head low, he stands in line among others, a morsel, mere wheel cog, back of chorus member, an innocuous, guileless particle in an average non-threatening wave among countless other waves, face apparently readable, posing no hint of danger. By not being noticed, he has a fuller chance of survival, so he waits on outskirts for time when his time may come or might come. Whether that would make sense without reading the I Ching to begin with, I don't know. But I'm just fascinated by the endeavour of it, you know, writing this absolutely massive sequence, because there are 64 hexagrams and he writes 7 poems about each.
It does sound like the sort of book you can dip into. And
definitely.
Kind of, maybe there's something about that, you know, the randomness of that, you know, the page you open at, the thing that you read. You know, maybe that's kind of what you're supposed to read for that moment in your life. I want to just say 2 words to you, Peter. Content warnings.
Okay.
I was doing my research into magazines to submit to for my little spreadsheet that I put together. And I've been taught...
Which is an amazing resource for
writers. Oh, thank you. Yeah. Oh, quick plug.
I use it all the time, actually. So.
Now, I was trawling through various magazines and quite a few American online poetry journals, and I came across a curious thing. There was one magazine which shall be nameless, but it had the whole of its latest edition was online on like a PDF, so I was able to scroll through. And at the beginning, after the index, there's an entire page entitled Content Warnings.
Ooh, yeah.
It could actually be a poem, except it's not in the index, so I assume it's not a poem, because it's a load of bullet points. And there are 13 sections with subheadings with bullet points underneath, and each bullet point is the name of a poem. So it's telling you which poems to avoid if you don't want to read about these topics. So we've got things like, you know, sexual content, fair enough. Divorce, you might be a bit sensitive to that. Domestic violence, you know, these are fair enough. Then we've got things like unspecified trauma. We've also got injury, brackets, I'm not kidding you, injury, brackets, including but not limited to castration and plane crashes.
Oh,
close
God.
Brackets. Then we've got animal death/death. There's quite a few, actually, quite a few poems seem to cover that topic. We've got internalized homophobia, grief, alcohol, illness, pandemic/COVID, hunting, and scars. So, as you know, quite a lot of ugly stuff going on in these poems. And you know, it's do we need this level of content warnings? I mean, what subjects are left to write about?
Yeah. What's left? Writing about kittens or something?
I do. Well, yeah, I wonder, actually. I don't know. I'm just curious. I'd love to know if somebody would like to fight their corner on this one and say, yeah, actually, I don't want to read about hunting, and I definitely don't want to read about a poem about castration. Well, I mean, you could say no to that on taste grounds, really, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Never mind being traumatised by it.
I've seen people on Insta, you know, put trigger warnings if they're talking about difficult things on their posts. So I guess it's just part of that.
Version of that. I know it is a thing, but I was just amazed at this level of detail.
Yeah.
And you know, one or two poems seem to have come up in three or four categories. And I'm thinking, God, I need to read that poem now. How you get plane crashes, alcohol and hunting in the same poem would be quite interesting. It could be a workshop test, couldn't it? A little exercise.
I can see why they're doing this, and it's probably useful for one or two of the readers.
Yeah.
But there's other content warnings I'd like to see, really, on Poetry Magazine.
Ah, yeah, okay.
I drop a quick quiz for you, Robin.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. I love a quiz.
And so I've invented categories, and you'll have to tell me what the offending content might be.
Okay, okay.
So, question one, research peacocks.
Oh, research peacocks. Oh, dear. Let me consult the I Ching. Ooh, peacock, something about eyes. I don't know.
No, you're going far too deeply.
Okay, I've given up. Tell me.
This is a shallow quiz. It's the writer's been on Google and wants you to know it.
Okay. Right. Okay. I've got the gist of it now. Right. Okay. Throw me another one.
Another content warning. Scaffolding.
Oh, egregious shouting and swearing and playing of the radio in the street.
Oh, that's interesting you went there. My answer to that was all form but no content.
Oh, that's very clever. Okay, I'll give you one more. I'm very bad at this, obviously.
Sudden giraffes.
Is this more animals again? Sudden giraffes. I have no idea.
That's an unearned metaphor. You're reading a poem and there's a sudden giraffe. I'm not sure if that was a success by Little Quiz, really. But
oh, sorry. Yeah, it was a bit too clever for me.
You can tell I've not set many quizzes before.